For April the 5th, 2024, we talk about Terra Invicta, Nexus 5X, Lunacid, and much more. Welcome to Level 495. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Furia.
I'm Ben Merkel.
And you are listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. A rare three style.
Yeah, I was going to lead with this. What's the frequency of this, Cole?
It's been a long time since I checked.
Okay.
Yeah. Well,
that's a type of rarity, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a spreadsheet, so I keep track of who's on which episodes to split the money. You know, so that just makes sense. So I have this data of who's been on what. Three styles are obviously pretty common, and you know, when you get down to like individuals who have been on shows with each other the most, that's when the math and analysis gets a little tricky.
Is that combinations or permutations? I forget.
Combinations.
Yeah.
Combinations.
And until we start cloning one another, it's combinations.
Right. But. So yeah, permutations would be Cole, and Jala.
Now that's a show I want to listen to.
Oh man, I would not want to do that to Jala.
Oh gosh, man.
Ben, what's going on?
Not much. In the ongoing saga of how my current workplace is better than my previous one, the boss of the company told everyone to walk outside for 20 minutes today because it was nice and sunny. So
fantastic.
I did that before the podcast. Yeah. Mm. I'm feeling pretty good. Went on a hike this weekend for Easter at Oyster Dome, which is a nice overlook of the San Juan Islands. So that's fun.
Nice. But,
Yeah.
I'm waiting for just a little bit of green to hit before I get back out, but I'm very much looking forward to going out and hiking.
Yeah, I'm sure there will be another like false like winter or something like that before it becomes summer official, but it does feel like the scale is tipped by now.
Yeah,
so.
It's relenting.
I'm out here in like shorts and a t-shirt more days than not now.
Hell
so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Well, sounds like you had a really pleasant weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dennis, how about you?
I'm good. I mentioned earlier, Jen is traveling for work, so I have to keep one ear out for kiddos. And you know, my recording station is kind of down in the basement at the kind of next to the stairs. And I hear my youngest calling for me, before we started recording. So I ran upstairs, you know, two flights of stairs to get to his room on the second floor. What's going on, bud? Oh, I'm missing my blankie. And he, to his credit, he knew exactly where it was. He's like, it's down in the basement. So I go down to literally next to the chair I was just sitting in, grab the blankie, run it upstairs to him, and then come back down. So I've been running vertical suicides right before we start recording here.
Yeah. Well, hey, it's good. Any way you can fit him in, get those steps, get those flights. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. And you know, Ben was saying like it's such a built-in fitness regimen being a parent of young kids.
Oh yeah.
And I realized like yeah, they even get slightly heavier every day. So like they kind of increase with your capacity.
A lot of core activation, leaning over, bending down to pick them up, you know, getting down to their level to play with them. Yeah.
A lot of reflexes. So I've noticed in all toddlers, there is like a compulsion to the second an adult's chin is about 1 to 2 inches above their head to jump vertically with more ferocity than I've ever seen an NBA player exert. So yeah, I've taken a couple on the chin that way.
You got to know to yank back. Huh?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But good times.
Cool. This is the quickest banter we've ever done, I think. Because I have been getting ready to go to Milwaukee. That's this weekend. Mm-hmm.
Can we go over the Kia Boy defenses or?
So I have a different car this time. It's still a Kia. It's still a Soul because that is a comfortable car for me, and also it is very cheap. Trust me, I explored my options for not rewarding that company for what they did to me. But all of those options are expensive. and I don't want to do that.
You were describing how Allegiant Airlines and Spirit Airlines work.
Yes. So I've got a new car that doesn't have the exploit. I have a wheel lock, like one of those club things to put on. So hopefully that will visually discourage. And I thought about writing a note saying like, hey, don't even bother to stick to the inside, but I worry that might be considered taunting them.
Yeah.
So I think I'm just going to do
this. This person's trying too hard.
Yeah. I think I'm just going to do the wheel lock, and that'll be good for anybody who, has tuned in between, and doesn't know what we're talking about. My car got stolen last year when I was in Milwaukee for the Midwest Gaming Classic by the Kia boys, a loose conglomeration of children following a TikTok craze to steal the very easily stealable Kias and Hyundais because of a corner that company got when they were making it. So yeah, it's
honestly that is probably better protection than anything you could do is the fact that the TikTok craze has kind of died down.
Maybe, but like
it's worth at least three wheel locks.
Maybe, yeah. I have no idea if the TikTok craze has died down. So I'm just going to just hope. I'm just going to hope and we'll see. That's all I can do.
Every time you come out and your car is still there, it'll just be a nice little surprise.
Yeah.
You set your expectations low.
Considering mine got taken almost literally after I parked it, I will be happy to even get one return to the car.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just hopefully you can get all your stuff out of it into the booth before they steal it.
Yeah, right. Well, I got all the stuff out of it, and thank God for small favors. I had already taken everything out of the car that we needed for the convention before I parked it. Like I checked in and then got everything out and then parked my car. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So yeah, but yeah, getting ready for that. I've also finished up the bulk of my spring cleaning, got all the closets, finished that up today, threw out so much stuff. I don't throw anything away. I think you all know that about me. I have things I really made a good effort to get rid of things that are like almost literally trash that I was just keeping around because maybe I would find a use for it or maybe I would fix it one day. Mm. I took a full shopping cart, what ended up being a full shopping cart of old electronics to Best Buy to recycle.
Oh, so many charging cords, I'm sure.
I mean, some of those were included. I still have the big closet shelf full of Sterilite bins, full of cords, all sorted and tied up. I've thinned those out substantially. But yeah, no, I'm talking a laptop that I had in 2007.
Oh yeah. God. Okay. Yeah.
Holding onto a Zune in case it makes a comeback.
Yeah. In case it has any irony appeal. Yeah. And what probably was about 10, 33 gallon bags of just shit. Not literal shit, but
Yeah, yeah.
One of them was literal shit.
How far is this going
to
go?
Yeah, yeah. I carry enough bags of shit out to the trash. That's because I own cats. But yeah, so that's nice.
Oh, here for the holding on to things angle. Tonight, we discovered Pokemon cards that my wife had in grade school.
Ooh. Mm-hmm.
So it was a room was getting cleaned out at the in-laws' house, and they brought out these two little hard cases of Pokemon cards, and it's like, I looked it up. There's like three or four that are worth $20 to $30.
Yeah.
The rest of it's like $2 a card. No big deal. But it's kind of cool to find these first generation Pokemon cards.
Oh yeah, I still have all of mine. And I have nephews who are confused as to why I do not give them to them.
Yeah.
But but that's that's easy. Like that's plenty easy to hold on. Most a couple of those are in boxes, but most of them are just in a binder. Like the good ones are in a binder,
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's compact. Yeah.
It's no laptop.
No laptop that was so old that at some point many years ago, I was alarmed to see that the battery had swollen out of it.
Ooh. Oh no, spicy pillow.
Yeah. So I got rid of that, and then kept the laptop around because it would still work with the charger.
Oh God. How far from actually being a laptop can we make this laptop?
Not coincidentally. This has nothing to do with me recently changing antidepressants. completely unrelated. Why do you ask?
Oh, wow.
Oh, God.
It's a perk.
So, yeah, that's really all that's happening. I am looking forward to Milwaukee. I'm much more looking forward to being back from Milwaukee. Because I like being home.
Sick burn on Milwaukee.
I like home more than any other place. So it's nothing Fair. On Milwaukee. It's on literally every place else. programming note, no episode next week. We're taking next week off to allow for decompression and, you know, sicknesses that we're surely going to get. So no episode here of this show, the one show that we record the week that it comes out.
Yeah, just record yourself coughing violently for a couple hours and then play that back. It'll be effectively what the show would be.
Yes. just me coughing and then like a very bad MIDI version of the funeral march. Oh, gosh. Yeah, I think we should talk about video games now. How do you feel about that?
Let's go.
Buttons.
All right. Let's do the regular kind of show, what with the grind, the multiplayer, and the end boss, and we can get started with...
The Grind.
The Grind, where we talk about the games we have been playing over the last period of time or so. Who has something new?
I do. I have something new that I was shamed into playing.
Ooh. Okay. I'm curious about this dynamic.
I like a shame start.
Well, no, you guys were there and you didn't protect me. Moxie last week brought up Terra Invicta.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Asked, why aren't you playing this? This is like literally the game for you.
Yeah.
So I couldn't not play it after that.
Strategy, like Earth management thing that just hit. It's like from XCOM developers. Mm-hmm. And Moxie's story last week was that it just hit Game Pass.
Yes, it is from, I don't know if it's they ever worked for Firaxis officially, mm-hmm. But they were the modders that created Long War.
Gotcha,
which is like
there we
the
go.
Quintessential mod for XCOM, making everything more difficult and time-consuming because the base game is not enough. You crazy people. They made an entire game, and I spent a couple hours with it. It is effectively if Crusader Kings was cosplaying as XCOM. That's what this feels like.
This sounds really good.
Yeah, right?
But you said that you played it, so it already doesn't feel like Crusader Kings.
Yeah, I crapped out in the tutorial of Crusader Kings. Got a little further in this.
Okay.
And yeah, the feel is very much the same. Like, you're looking at this giant map of Earth that you can rotate all the way around. That's right, we're not even in space yet. You know, you start in Earth. Finding out that you're not alone because an alien, you know, spacecraft crashes somewhere on Earth. And so all these different factions, as humanity realizes we're not alone, are scrambling for influence, for, you know, control of the site where the UFO crashed and control over what humanity broadly does next. So you start, you know, on a map of the globe. You're trying to control regions, countries, exert your influence there, and everything you do in the game is at the what I would call the strategic layer in XCOM. So you're looking at this map, you're sending people places, you're making choices and seeing the ramifications of those choices. But Terra Invicta does not have a tactical layer where you are like ordering soldiers around a battlefield and managing missed shot percentages.
It's a grand strategy.
Exactly. Grand strategy game. And to some extent, like just in terms of chillness, I quite appreciate that. But in terms of getting immediate like feedback and reward on your choices, that does take a hit. I can't help but compare it to XCOM. I'll talk in a second. I've, you know, been playing XCOM again as well. And in XCOM, you know, you're making these choices at the strategic layer of the game, And then you go into the tactical lair and see those choices have impact immediately and definitively on your soldiers. You know, people will die because you didn't have the right ability, or because you chose to give them this weapon instead of that weapon, or you know, you got too greedy trying to bring some rookies to level up your squad, and they get wiped out. Like it feels very, very impactful every single choice you make. With Terra Invicta, it's like, okay, I'll send this ambassador to examine the UFO site. I will set my research priorities in this way, and I will send another ambassador to try to influence this country. And yeah, it does. They're all doing those things.
Instantly happens. Yeah. What's your next thing? There's no like breakup and flow.
Well, yeah. there is a clock that's marching forward. So you send someone to influence the country. It takes a couple weeks for that to happen. And so, you know, days are ticking by like a day, a second, or however fast you do it, but you don't have anything to do during that time except for manage other pieces of the grand strategy layer. And, you know, there are so many different things that you can tinker with and, you know, change what corporations your ambassadors are involved with, which gives them different perks that make them better at different things. Your research part, it's interesting the way they handle research. So there's a ton of different resources in the game, influence, money, research is one of them, but it's not something that you can increase your capacity for. It is simply a percentage allotment. How much of your focus are you putting on different priorities? And those priorities will advance at a different rate. So if you put 100% of your focus on one priority, it's going to advance very quickly, but then you're not going to get anything else done. And so you can split 50-50. Basically every potential resource priority can have up to 3 pips on it. And you can place as many or as few pips as you want. And then your research focus is going to be divided in that way, which is very interesting because at any given time there are 3 like global research projects, and then up to 3 private research projects. So the global ones, when you research it, every faction on Earth gets access to whatever the result of that research is, and it kind of represents the forward march of progress, I guess. And then the private research, when you complete that, you alone benefit from it. However,
I have a question. With the public one, like, is the idea you pick research things that like disproportionately benefit your particular faction over everyone else then, or?
Well, that is the push and pull. So there's 3 that I think you just start with. Like, you don't get a say in. Whoever contributes the most to a given piece of global research is the one who gets to choose what the next thing is after that piece of research completes. So there are always 3 global projects. When one wraps up, whoever invested the most research effort in it, and you can see the tracker, by the way, and the clock of how much time is left from the get-go, whoever contributed the most then picks what the globe focuses on next. And so it's a really creative way to have this, you know, a rising tide raises all ships, but also, you know, those who are investing the most get to direct where the ships go next.
Right.
This is for any board game listeners out there, this is a little bit like a mechanic in Endeavor, where it's like whoever has the majority gets a prize whenever you hit this like sailing thing. But anyway.
Yeah, sure. And you know, that prize is more influence, not the currency, but literal influence on what's researched.
Yeah. Obviously what they pick is going to be in line with their broader goals or philosophy for
exactly.
What it is.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
So we had a question about that though. They're picking what's researched next. Okay, so when somebody's can, but you said there's 3 goals, so like that's filling out one, but the other 2 are still existing. So somebody could choose to just like go hardline into something that only benefits them and just kind of ignore whatever the popular research is. Is that right?
Yeah. So basically, you could do that, and that means that whenever that completes, you would get the next choice. But then there's 2 other research priorities that you just get no say in. And are advancing potentially slower than they would. There's also the element of maybe other factions get pissed off at you if you're not pulling your weight in terms of research.
Mm-hmm.
Like if all you do is throw yourself into private research and kind of shun the global community, not only do you not get a say, but other factions are going to be pissed off at you.
Yeah, we'll take it on.
And it's that kind of Crusader Kings 3 feel of like literally every choice I make here is going to have an impact and is going to change the way people perceive me and my faction.
And it sounds like it has like multiple impacts.
Yes. Down to like, you know, like I said, your primary verb is sending ambassadors. So, you know, I talked about the research panel. Then there's also sending ambassadors, which is kind of the primary way you interact with everything else. And you can send them to do pretty much anything. You can try to gain influence in a country. You can send them to sabotage another faction in a country. You can send them to go meet with someone else's ambassador. You can send them to try to go find an ambassador that you don't know where they are. It's like just on down the line to where, like, you know, for one thing, I had my person or one of my ambassadors contact another faction's ambassador just because we were in the same place. It was the country with the UFO crash site. And I was like, what's this guy doing here? Like, you know, going to talk with him. And, you know, it pulls up a window when that assignment completes that is like a trade negotiation between the two factions. And there's like a list of things that you can ask for or resources that the other faction has. And then there's a list of your resources and things you can offer. And you kind of get feedback based on what you put on the table of what they might be willing to do. So I played around with that a little bit. And we couldn't come to any agreeable terms, and, you know, left without making any kind of a deal. But again, I feel like that's got ripple effects now of, okay, well, at least I've contacted them and, you know, now you gain a little bit of information about the other ambassadors. Ambassadors have a loyalty stat. So there's stuff like negotiation and espionage and all that stuff. The final stat for every ambassador is perceived loyalty. And it's got a question mark next to the number.
So oh, that's like, that's an amazing stat. I love it.
Yes. And you can send an ambassador to spy on your own ambassador, mm-hmm. like another ambassador of yours, to like get more certainty on what that number is. It's incredible.
Is it like there's a number of question marks following it for how sure you are?
No, but the number is red instead of white and all the other numbers are white. That's very disconcerting. Like, mm-hmm. it doesn't make me think that they might be more loyal than I'm assuming.
No.
So yeah, like it's really got that feel of depth. But as I mentioned kind of at the top, the trade-off for focusing at that level is no single thing feels particularly urgent or impactful, right? Mm-hmm. The first ambassador I sent to try to gain influence in a country failed that mission. And I just like, you can select, repeat and continue and basically like, okay, you're going to stay here and try to do this until it's successful.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, well that, you know, then it's not a matter of if I can do this thing. It's a matter of how long will it take me to do this thing?
Mm-hmm.
And how much resources will it cost me? Which again, there's fun to be had there. It's cool to be able to manage all that, especially at the level of depth that this game gives you, but it's just not as urgent as like, this is a 70% shot. And if I miss, it probably means curtains for the soldier I'm aiming with.
Yeah.
Do I have a backup plan? Can I, you know, do anything to influence that? That XCOM intensity is not there, which like, let's be honest, and I'll talk about it in a second. I could use a break from time to time.
Yeah. Grand strategy games like this, yeah, you know, like a lot of games are effectively, you know, spreadsheets. Whose rules sure. are obfuscated by, you know, theming and a front end and a user interface. But you know, a lot of it ultimately comes down to figures in a cell.
Mm-hmm.
Grand strategy games are a little bit more nakedly that. And I can totally understand how steering a big ship might be a little bit less engaging than being somebody on the boarding party. Mm-hmm. You know, going somewhere else. It's an entirely different kind of game.
Yes. It honestly makes me even more curious about Long War, because I have not actually played that mod.
Oh.
I've been a little intimidated by it, just the fact that it, you know, XCOM is already so notoriously long and difficult. How could you make it more long? And maybe not more difficult, but more intricate, is the right way to think about it. So if Terra Invicta turns out being too zoomed out for me, maybe the right balance between the two will be Long War. Only time will tell.
I'm surprised you haven't played
lots
that.
Lots and lots of time.
Yeah.
Well, I've always wanted to beat, I think it's Legend Iron Man is the hardest difficulty on XCOM 2. And I have never been able to do that. And so it's one of those things where, like, I would have to effectively give up on that to allow myself to then go to Long War.
Mm.
And yeah, so my, any other questions on Terra Invicta first off before I jump on?
No, everything you said just sounded like Coldplay this game, Coldplay this game, Coldplay this game. So,
Well, it's free on Game Pass, as Moxie pointed out. So yeah, the actual on ramp for Terra Invicta was kind of funny for me because I went and found it on Game Pass. I downloaded it and then I booted up XCOM 2.
That's the wrong thing. It's the wrong executable.
It's the wrong button. It just got me thinking, and I was like, you know, I think I was in the middle of a campaign the last time I was playing XCOM. I think it was going kind of well. I should drop in. Yeah, I should check in. Oh, this is, yeah. Oh, I'm actually pretty far in this. Why did I stop playing? And then what was going on? And then I was playing it again.
I could mail this rent check, but I played the slots instead.
Yes. and so that kind of got the needle back in, and I've spent this week playing XCOM 2. That Iron Man campaign that I had abandoned however long ago, was what I started out playing again. Didn't lose it or anything, but I realized it was on the second to hardest difficulty, not the hardest difficulty.
Oh, well, it might as well. It's not worth it at all.
Yeah.
Right. Immediately bounced out and started a new Legend Iron Man campaign. So for point of reference, at the beginning of this week, I was around 36 or something, 30-ish. Mid 30s of attempts at the Legend Iron Man campaign.
Okay.
And at the beginning today, of the week, productive member of society as well.
Yeah. Yes. today, I am on attempt number 95.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Tried, what is that, 60-ish? Campaigns?
I didn't realize that XCOM was a roguelike that you're turning it
right,
into.
That is exactly what I'm doing. Well, okay, so XCOM 2.
Dennis, oh, go ahead. You know we care about you, right?
Right. Oh, trust me, I'm so happy. It looks like I'm seething at that missed shot, but I am so happy. First off, it was just shaking the rust off. Like, you know, remembering all the things not to do. And then there's kind of a four mission on ramp to the campaign, with the fourth mission being this really, really difficult kind of make or break mission. And it's like, if you don't do well in that, it's really not worth continuing.
Yeah, it's a gut check.
It is absolutely. It's a I think it's called a retaliation strike. Basically, the bad guys invade one of the resistance camps, and you're showing up without your stealth, with more difficult enemies than you've ever seen before, trying to save civilians. So there's like the tutorial mission, there's a regular mission, there is a zombies mission, they call them Lost, for lack of a better term, and then there's this, you know, this retaliation strike. And yeah, all but one or two of those 60. We're going to say it was more like 50 attempts. That sounds better. It was just in that four mission window.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, first off, shaking the rust off and then getting a little further each time. And I've really roguelike to the hell out of it, Ben, to use your analogy, where it's just, you know, rediscovering all the mechanics and remembering what works, what doesn't. And then really... not knuckling down too hard or like focusing too much on the micro, which leads to a lot of the restarting. But it's just fun to be playing XCOM 2 again.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's it is coming home in a way, I guess. This is my favorite game of all time, and I'm surprised that I stayed away from it as long as I did. however, I might be staying away from it for a bit again, given my latest experience. So, had my deepest run yet, going extremely well. This was through the 4-mission on-ramp. This was, I mean, probably 9-10 missions in, something like that. Like, I really had my feet under me. Started getting some high-level soldiers. And did a protect the device mission, which is you spawn into the map. There's a device that you need to protect on the other side of it. And Advent forces are kind of swarming it. So you need to get to it and defend it until all the enemies that started on the map are dead. This was also a zombies one, so it had the Lost on it, which made things extra chaotic. And the Chosen, that would, like, basically a boss character, spawned in on this. Uh-oh. So, like, it's all, you know, uphill. I'm like, all right, this is the one that, you know, goes bad for me. Except everything goes right. Like, it just some crazy lucky shots, yes. But also, like, tactically, I was on point. Just seeing around corners, everything felt like it was clicking. You know, people went where I guessed they were going to go. This is great. Finish off all the regular enemies.
Uh-oh.
Finish off the Chosen.
Uh-oh.
And the mission doesn't end.
Uh-oh.
The zombies on the map, by the way, are like endless spawning hordes. So once all the Advent are gone and your device is still up, the mission's supposed to end. So now I'm just running around the map like a chicken with my head cut off, trying to figure out what's going on. Did I miss an Advent soldier? Did, you know, what happened? There's more. I mean, there's probably 60 lost zombies running around the map. And it's just a game of numbers, right? It, like, I just start taking a little chip damage here and there. And eventually, finally, I'm like, why? Like, it's got to be a bug. Start searching. And I find out that there's apparently a bug where if the zombies kill an Advent character before you discover them,
ooh,
it soft locks the mission and there's no way out.
Iron Man.
I bet they fixed that in Long War.
I wonder. And that, yeah, the recommended workaround is just don't do this mission type.
Like, oh God.
If you're given the choice, choose something else. If you're not given the choice, fail the mission. Because this is not worth. And I could evac out as a failure, but at that point I had lost so many soldiers and the one remaining guy was injured. It was just like, well, that was my A team. So that happens.
It's now and Darkest then I, Dungeon.
Right. I'm like, all right, you know, that's it's bound to happen. I you know, go back and play a little more. And then today, so this was like yesterday, today I played the game in the morning. I left for a little bit because we had a repairman come over for some AC stuff. Came back down, like the computer hadn't gone to sleep, nothing had crashed. I go to boot XCOM 2 back up and it won't start.
Oh God.
I'm like, what in the world? Like, I literally did nothing in between playing it and coming back to it.
You just get a message from Steam and it's like, this is for your own good.
You broke it, yeah. Dennis.
I think I did. And like I searched around on this and there's a little listicle with like 9 different things to do to fix the potential crash.
All of that's AI slop. Yeah.
Oh, I believe it. I got all the way through the 9th and it's still not working. So I don't know what comes next. So maybe the game got worried. They're like, he's getting a little too good. we gotta think outside the box to stop him.
Just a blaring siren went off over at Firaxis.
Yeah. That's my story through. And I'm sticking to it. So we'll see how much effort I feel like throwing at this to continue playing. But yeah, it has been a space alien based strategy kind of week for me.
Sounds like it.
I want to point out the game that you talked about, was it Terra Invictus or whatever, is in early access still. It's not fully released.
And well, that was another thing that kind of put XCOM on my mind is I went to the subreddit for Terra Invicta and asked like, hey, I love XCOM, never played Long War, but I hear, you know, Terra Invicta is by those people. What do you guys recommend I do? And consensus was kind of like, you won't hurt by waiting on Terra Invicta because it's still being finished. Mm-hmm. So like if there's other content that you haven't seen yet, aka Long War, or just more XCOM, you know, start there and Terra Invicta will be better when you come to play it later.
I still
wanted to play it just to check it out and, mm-hmm. and you know, get a different flavor, and I'm happy with the time I spent with it. But yeah, it is an early access game that is still very much being polished, and you know, knowing the reputation of these Long War modders, they pay attention to detail, they get it right. This game has a long and healthy future ahead of it.
Hmm. Nice.
And yeah, that is me. Oh, I played more Hellcard.
Right.
The deck builder that I talked about last week. I won't say much new about it. I unlocked a new class, which was kind of cool. It's the Tinkerer, and cards have a mana cost, and then some cards have, basically, there are two other types of mana that you can generate. So there are some basic cards that only cost the base kind of mana, but generate this other kind of mana, and then there's more powerful cards that you can only spend the generated mana on. And so it's this whole kind of getting the machine, exactly, the whole secondary economy up and running in the space of the game. And I've really enjoyed that. Feels completely different from the warrior beat him over the head with a stick class that I played on my first run. So not much else to say on that, but still checking it out.
Hmm.
And that's me.
Cool. Ben, how about you?
Yeah, I don't have anything new. I just kind of got more of the same, but I still can find things to talk about that. So I'm going to. I played Nexus 5X last week again. I played with some friends online, and so that was good to get like a second experience for it. So it was just three players instead of like the first time I played with like six or eight. Mm-hmm. It was good. I enjoyed it. However, it's good to play that game with at least four players because you can play minimum four players. And if you have less humans than that, it's replaced with like AI. So the person who won the jellyfish friendly race just so happened that the computer like gave them all their votes for the council meetings so they could pass anything they want. I'm not bitter about it at all, but it was still a fun experience. I think everyone else who played it liked it. So I think we're going to probably play it again tomorrow and try and get four people in on it. So that's still a game where that's another one where it's like space, early access, all like grand strategy-y. But I do enjoy playing that game. I think that it doesn't feel as daunting as some of the other grand strategy games, even though it does have like a similar level of complexity. Mm-hmm. Like it feels like you can kind of slowly learn the pieces and still get some enjoyment out of it.
This is the Stellaris that is broken down to have shorter, like, two-hour rounds?
Exactly, yeah. And the big quality of life improvement is that people take their turns simultaneously, and it gets resolved all at one time. Yeah, I feel like that's probably, like, the future of, like, board games as well. if you can do that, that's pretty big. So anyway, not much more to say to it besides what I said, I think, one or two weeks ago about it. But it's still an enjoyable experience.
Sorry, I was on mute. How interactive does it feel when everyone is doing their turn at the same time?
It's still interactive. It's just that things might take a turn to resolve. So like when you're doing actions, it's like, I'm going to send diplomats to them, or I might make like a treaty agreement with them, or I might like make a trade deal with them. And so on your action, you're just sending the people. And then the next turn that'll resolve in some way, like say they accepted the diplomacy agreement, then you both get a victory point or you both get resources or whatever. So they deal with the asynchronous actions pretty well. And then like the way like combat and stuff works is like if you both happen to travel to the same place, then you'll fight at the end of the round. And sometimes
but
that
the
can
decision
be like,
to travel there happens simultaneously.
Yeah. So sometimes that can be a surprise where it's like you didn't know somebody else was traveling there, but they did. So now you're fighting, you know. So it can be a little bit awkward. Yeah, especially if you don't have like a agreement with somebody. It's still enjoyable.
That's my feel or my experience in the board game world has been that like the more you're able to do things simultaneously, the more it feels like you're not interacting with the people around, almost by definition, right? Because you're all focused on your own thing at the same time. I think that's what I want to see, is a game that finds a way to allow everyone to be taking their turn at once, but still has interdependence and negotiation and conversation and stuff, interaction happening within that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And yeah, there are some board games that suffer from this, where it's like the interaction is so low that everyone's kind of siloed and playing their own game, but you still have the negative of you have to wait for everybody to take their turn.
And then at the end we count victory points, and whoever got the most victory points in their own little solitaire match wins.
But that said, sometimes it's like the engine building's so fun that doesn't matter. But but yeah, this is like a good game if like you want like kind of a social experience and something that can get done in like 1 or 2 hours. So it's good for like an online game night if you have any of that going on. But yeah, other than that, I'm going to probably keep playing it every so often, but yeah, I don't know. We'll see how it progresses. I'm interested to see like what they'll change when they like full release it. Similar to what you're talking about with like the Tinker race, like pretty much every race in the game has something like that, where everybody has their own specific secondary economy. Like I think the space rats, which I described last week, they have like salvage is like their economy. So it's like they can go to sites where people fought and like collect salvage, and they use that to build buildings instead of their like regular action. And like other people will have like diplomacy, and they'll have some sort of secondary economy with that, and they'll use that to do special actions on their own. So I'll be interested to see where it goes from here, but I think it's a pretty good experience, so it does have some potential.
But is there a particular galactic civilization that you find yourself kind of gravitating toward? Like, what sticks out to you as, like, your jam?
Yeah, I don't think I've found one that's like, oh, this is the one that I, like, have to play as. Which, I don't know if that's a good or bad thing. Like, on the one hand, it's good that they're, like, balanced in a way that there's not, like, an odd job of the factions where it's, like, everyone goes for that. On the other hand, it's, like, it could stand a feel a little bit more specialized. I know it's a very board game reference heavy episode already, but the touchstone I have for this is there's a board game called Gaia Project where it does an extremely good job of every faction will have a very significant unique ability so that it feels like you are doing things that only you can do. This doesn't quite reach that sort of level. The Nexus 5X doesn't reach that level where you're like, oh, sweet, this is like an amazing thing I can do with this faction. Or at least I haven't felt that yet. And maybe I'm just missing like the depth of the rules, you know, before I can feel that way. But it does feel, at least currently, that like there's room for them to kind of enhance like the asymmetry of it and make that like more pronounced between the races and make that more like satisfying to play as. Mm-hmm. But I think like Space Eagles have been my favorite one because you can kind of like burn actions in your queue and kind of control like what your moves are in the future. And it just seemed to work decently well. So, the other game that I have to talk about is I've continued playing a good amount of Balatro, the card game Slay the Spire-esque game. But
Poker the Spire.
Yeah.
Flush the Spire.
Yeah. Slay the Spade. I don't know. That game's still been good. I'm like working up the difficulty tree on that one. So I've gotten to the fourth difficulty of like six or seven. Each difficulty that you beat will unlock a new deck. And I don't think I've necessarily won with the latest one that I've unlocked. But I've continued playing that, and it's like the difficulty is similar to like the Ascension and Slay the Spire. They'll add some sort of mechanic to make the run harder. So it'll be like the way it's structured is like Slay the Spire, you have the map that you go through. And this one, it's like instead of a map, you have these things progressively increased blinds, and you have like three per quote unquote map, and you have eight maps instead of three maps, like in Slay the Spire.
Yeah, and you can decide to if you want to spend resources to skip one of the blinds.
Exactly. And you don't even have to spend resources. It's if you skip the blind, you just don't go to the store afterwards.
Right.
But it'll give you some sort of reward instead. And then in higher difficulties, the first blind does not pay you any money for completing it. So it kind of incentivizes you to skip that one more often, since you're still getting a benefit for skipping and you're not getting any money for going through and beating like the score. The only complaint I have with the game, I mean, I'm still playing and I still enjoy it, so don't get me wrong. But the kind of complaint I have with it is it feels like kind of like the some of the Slay the Spire classes. It feels like, okay, this is the winning strategy, and like that's what you have to go for. And like the other ones, it's like much less probable or much more rare for this like strategy to pay off. So an example of this is like a pretty good winning strategy is trying to duplicate cards as much as possible so that you can get five of a kind with something mm-hmm. and just go for that all the time. As opposed to a different strategy is like, say, having all your deck be the same suit and just trying to buff the score for flushes and just do flushes over and over. While that can be nice, it doesn't like scale as well, and you're not likely to like clear the game doing that strategy. Mm-hmm. So it does feel a bit unbalanced in that sense, where there's like, it feels like certain strategies are the winning strategies and the other ones you kind of have to ignore. That said, there's still a good amount of randomness where a lot of it just depends on like what jokers come out. Mm-hmm. And so that's both good and a bad thing. Like good because it makes the runs pretty novel and you kind of have to adjust on the fly. But then the bad thing is it feels like there's a lot of like helplessness where it's like, well, there was no like, I felt like there was no winning line in this run because there was no like good joker that came out or there was no good like skip buff that came out. Mm-hmm. There was no way for me to deal like with what was going on. I guess to mitigate that, the runs are pretty quick. So it's like if you play and lose, you can just start another one and it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
But it would be a bit nicer if there's kind of like a more of a slower buildup, like in Slay the Spire, and you had more autonomy over like the direction in which you're heading, and kind of it was a more directed experience instead of kind of like luck of the draw. Mm-hmm. And then likewise, that kind of goes within the card game itself, where it's like if you just don't get the hands together when you discard or play things, it feels somewhat powerless, where there's like not as much you can do there. I've been trying to compare it to Slay the Spire, where it's like Slay the Spire, one of the even though, potions are very temporary reward, they're really good as, like, oh shit mitigators, where it's like, if you get in a situation where you're about to die, that's kind of like your saving grace out of it. Balatro doesn't exactly have the same feature, because you can get cards to, like, modify your cards that are in your hand, like remove some or change the suit of some, something stuff like that, turn a card wild or buff it or something like that. But unlike Slay the Spire, you're almost always incentivized to use that card immediately because that'll increase the probability that you're making something good, as opposed to like holding on to it for a like get out of jail situation.
I mean, and there's basically no look ahead really, beyond at most like two rounds, right?
Yeah. That part's a little bit different. Yeah. With the horizon, which you can see. So I think
I feel like that's what gets the really high tier players coming back to Slay the Spire is you can think ahead. I mean, not just through turns, but through combats and through acts, and like that you can really think out the implications of your actions so far into the future that it rewards that level of thinking and mastery. It sounds like I wonder as Balatro stays out here if people will fall away if they feel like okay I've mastered everything I can, but like the ability to predict out into the future has reached its limit faster than in Slay the Spire.
As somebody who really doesn't play a lot of these games, I am super okay with one of these deck building roguelikes existing in the market to be played for about 3 months and then left behind.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to make that sound denigrating. I'm just wondering if that will, if where community consensus will land on Balatro as time goes on.
Yeah. It's just, so many games are designed around keeping people locked in for some kind of like weird invisible KPI. you know, and this is an indie developer, so they're not necessarily beholden to that, but it is still like considered to be like, you need to make this a forever game for the people who bought it.
Sure.
Yeah. So I'm not like tisking you for bringing that up as a concern. I just want to advocate for maybe it can just die.
Things should end.
Yeah.
I do think it's interesting with this game in particular that the theming is so abstract that it's kind of just like the mechanics are what's kind of carrying the game. And that a game can be viable just on like solid, you know, like upgrade and like progression mechanics alone.
I love Monster Train. I haven't read a single bit of lore text and I try my best not to look at the art.
You know? I play blindfolded.
It's just pure wireframe, right?
Yeah. No, yeah, that's a fair point. And that's another good example too, where it's like, yeah, I don't know how many people are playing that game for like, yeah, the seven levels of hell, this is sweet. You know, it's just good mechanics. I mean, I still got some mileage with this. Like I don't think I'm near the end of playing it. Like it is like a nice, it's kind of my like idle time filler. I don't think it'll have the same sort of legs that Slay the Spire will, but it's still enjoyable. I mean, I might even rebuy it for the Switch if it's like something I would want to play like on the airplane, that sort of thing.
Spender.
So. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
It's good on the Switch. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So anyway, that's all I got. I've just been replaying games that I've already talked about. So
cool. So I only have, I have one game and then a recommendation based on something I'm covering for another show. So the game that I finished Alone in the Dark, the 2024 one, starring David Harbour and some actress who people in chat knew that I do not know who she is. She seems fine, though. Wrap that up. I was about halfway through last time, and then finished up the back half.
Was the giant tentacle monster in fact the final boss?
There is a giant tentacle monster that is a final boss.
Okay.
Yes, because it's Lovecraftian, right? You know, the story primarily, concerns itself with somebody who made a deal with Nyarlathotep in order to keep the black goat of a thousand young, Shub-Niggurath, sealed up inside this place. The ending is bonkers. True to this game being kind of a throwback to PS3 era survival horror games, the final boss is a disaster. It is way too HP spongy. There is no feedback for when you are doing damage. It summons adds to fight you and still does damage to you while you're fighting them. You're in too small of an arena. The ammo pickups are not limited, but health pickups are. I had to bump down to easy for the final.
I was going to say, this sounds perfect for Twitch streaming.
Yeah. I bumped down to easy after about three tries at it.
Thank God you can change difficulty midstream.
I know, right? So, like, this is a... it's like... It's not quite a 7 out of 10 game and all of that entails, you know, like when I think of a 7 out of 10 game, I think of a flawed, but still recommendable game to the point where I have, you know, dear loyalty to it. Your Silent Hill 4s or your Breath of Fire 3s, right? Games that didn't light the world on fire and underwhelmed a lot of people, but I still have a great amount of affection. This falls below that. This is like a 6.5 out of 7. So it does not gain the halo that a 7 out of 10 would. In the common parlance.
Wait, hold on. Is 6.5 out of 7 higher than 7 out of 10?
Sorry, I misspoke. 6.5 out of 10, rather. Yes.
Maybe like a 6.66 out of 10 or something.
No. Yeah. No. Sorry. Yeah. No. So 6.5 out of 10 as opposed to a 7.5 out of 10. By which I mean, like, this is a functional game that it has no real problems with it until the end. There are some neat puzzles. And, you know, the combat is there, but not especially egregious up until the final boss. The story is cool if weird, and is told in interesting ways. It relies a lot on kind of in-game documentation in a way that journal entries and stuff that you find in a way that survival horror games kind of stopped doing recently. There's a lot that's actually like pretty neat about this, but like it ends up just kind of being blah, to a degree. Like, of the survival horror games that have come out recently, this would not be like a run, don't walk kind of thing to me. Since I finished it and I'm, feel pressured internally to come up with some kind of like final synopsis, right? Like, the combat's just not great. I don't see a reason for it to be there if it is going to be as kind of like half-baked as it is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You gotta have something for the player to do, I guess.
You do, yeah. And, exploring the spaces and finding the doodads and figuring out what to do with them. And the puzzles are not just, find the right key and then find the keys, the keyhole for it to go into. It's not all that. There are a few like noggin scratcher kind of things there, at least that give you a few more tasks to do before you get the answer. So like, there's stuff to do. It's just, I don't know. If the combat was stronger, I think I would give this a little bit of higher praise. And I am not dinging it at all for the plentiful jank that is in there. To me, that is a positive, just the weird little animation snapping and stuff like that. To me, that is part of the charm. Yeah.
Very cool.
So yeah, Alone in the Dark, I wish it was better, but it was fun to stream. Because there are two selectable characters, I was curious if it would bear streaming again. I played with the David Harbour character, with Edward Carnby, the first time. And I took a look to see how different the other one is. The campaigns are basically the same, except with a couple of different cutscenes, and each character has like one character specific level as they go into a Silent Hill 2-esque realm to deal with a personal failure that that the forces are trying to break your mind with, right? So it's not one where it's like Resident Evil 2 where I'm going to turn right around and play it and get a substantially different experience.
So it sounds like there's room for DLC to add third and fourth characters.
Maybe there's DLC. I don't know. I'll keep an eye. I didn't hate it, but I wish I loved it. I think is where it comes down. Yeah, I just can't. So, oh well. Any other questions about Alone in the Dark?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I'm going to bring this next one up, not necessarily because I feel like I have an awful lot to say here that I will not say tomorrow when we record the WAF about it, but I want to recommend to you here, and also to anybody who's listening who does not listen to Watch Out for Fireballs, a game called Lunacid is one of the best games I've played in recent times. So it's like Luna with CID at the end. It's like Luna Acid, Lunacid.
What is this? Should I be searching on Steam for it?
It's on Steam. It's an indie game that is a throwback to the action RPGs that FromSoft made before Demon's Souls, Dark Souls. It is a Kingsfield and Shadow Tower alike. First person.
Wow. This looks Kingsfield as fuck.
It is so Kingsfield. It is like pitch perfect. The world is amazing. The weapons you get are broken. You get super goofy spells. The music is on point. This is a fucking triumph is what Lunacid is. And I understand if going back and playing Kingsfield, even Kingsfield 4, which is one of the best games ever made, I understand if going back and doing that feels like a little bit too much just because it's old and clunky. This is a modern reproduction of that clunk that I feel is more approachable and will give you a good sense of what is special about those games. I adore this game.
Can you talk about like the art? I assume there's like RPG elements of it then as well, or
yeah, it's like action RPG. You kill enemies and they, you know, drop, you get experience and you get money. Most of the improvement is through weapons, and the weapons do different kinds of damage and also have different kind of abilities to them. The combat is there and it's very slow and deliberate, like in Kingsfield. More of what the draw of the game is outside of the combat is navigating these maze like spaces and, you know, getting a, you know, kind of an earlier and almost like more meaningful version of what you get in a Souls game when you feel entirely lost and then you get a shortcut that takes you back to someplace familiar. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, like, the entire space is recontextualized and you just have it internalized, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kingsfield did that before Dark Souls, before Demon Souls, and this is picking up on that very well, I think.
Hmm.
Yeah. Aesthetic is on point. It is a throwback to PS1 style stuff.
Yeah. Forgive my ignorance. Is the hand just being disembodied part of a Kingsfield reference, or is that just their own choice?
I think it's just their own choice because they didn't want to animate an arm attached to it.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
An arm is the least exciting thing to animate.
Yeah. So you have a hand. You barely notice that it's just a hand. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. It's really good. One of my highest recommendations I can make, I think. So
that, oh, sweet. That sounds high.
Yeah.
Now I do, looking at the Steam page, the 1.1.0 patch looks like it has a bunch of Christmas lights folded into what I assume is a common area. So is this a live service game?
No. I think the creator just had a fun time joke and decorated the hub. You know, the hub area, Wings Rest, with some Christmas stuff.
Nice.
So, yeah.
I think the level of interest I have in this game is, like, directly related to, like, how much variability you have with, like, the class building type stuff. Because, like, that's what I loved about the Dark Souls part is, like, oh, let's just try this build. And it's like, oh, wow, it's a completely different game if you do this.
Yeah. You end up doing a little bit of everything in these games, you know? It's kind of a throwback to dungeon crawlers in that way, where you're going to have to do some casting, you're going to have to do some, range combat, things like that, in order to, like, solve the puzzles. So it's not necessarily the most, the deepest, you know, building game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It looks sweet though.
Yeah, it's really good. It hit some buttons for me. It was cool to play something made by somebody who likes Kingsfield as much as I do. Yeah.
Sweet.
Cool. And that's all I got.
Multiplayer.
Now it is time for the multiplayer, where we ask you a question and you answer. Dennis, what is the question you ask the nice people?
Yeah, I'm thinking this week about all those tactics. Rocket jumping is the big one. That people find that kind of go directly against the fiction of the game. But they are either so effective or so fun that you can't pass it up. In no world where you're playing a military game does it make sense to fire an RPG into your feet. but if that allows you to fly across the map at high speeds, why not? What tricks like that do people enjoy?
Yeah. I'll get us started with Peter, who says, in Final Fantasy II, going into the final boss of the first act and act with an overly decked out build is always fun. This is the one where you can literally punch your own team to build up their HP stat. So basically, my team would beat themselves for their first like 100 battles or so until my team's main three characters had max HP stats. Yeah.
The old self-flagellate strategy.
Yeah, it's the Lamarckian advancement there. You know, you have every character stretch out their neck eventually, and they'll become a giraffe, right?
Mm-hmm. which summon is a giraffe most like?
That's
what we got to figure out.
Yeah, no, it would be like Ixion, probably.
Yeah, that feels right.
Yeah. Let's see, Ben, what does Callum say?
Callum says, in Shining Force 1 and 2, using egress to flee battles you had won, having left one dude alive, so you could fight it again for XP farming.
Oh, snap.
All right, everybody, back to one.
Again.
Yeah. I wish Jala was here so she could comment on this. She would. Yeah. Dennis, what's Adam say?
Adam says, in Metal Gear Solid, when you get to the nuclear warhead storage room, Snake is told not to use weapons since they could damage the nukes, and that would be bad. The game actually locks weapons, but I learned the weapons only lock after crossing the doorway. You can lay in the doorway, equip the PSG-1, and snipe the guards.
I mean, you're That's technically excellent. Following the recommendation that Otacon made.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's great.
I think foreshadowing for how you deal with the end in Metal Gear Solid 3 as well.
One of the ways you can deal with the end.
Yeah.
Steven writes, fun trick in Grand Theft Auto 4. If you jump while going upstairs, you can clear the entire flight in one go. It looks ridiculous, but it's way too effective to pass up.
Oh, I didn't know that one. Yeah. I sank a significant amount of time into GTA 4, too.
Yeah. I mean, and movement in that game is so awkward that I could see it being beneficial.
Oh, yeah.
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 That's like the fork in the road for Rockstar, where they're like, let's do realism in games. Forget about that fun component of it.
Yeah. I mean, then they gave us Grand Theft Auto 5 with Trevor, and those missions are fun.
Yeah.
The realism in Grand Theft Auto 5, where if, you know, you tilt your vehicle up in the air, it will fly longer.
Yeah. But Grand Theft Auto 4 has more in common with Red Dead, right?
Mm,
that was their...
Yeah, it feels right.
That was their vibe at that point, I think. Ben, round us out with what Random Sum says.
Random Sum says, having all your buddies beat up on each other so you can rack up some easy job points in Final Fantasy Tactics is a classic move. Hey, gang, maybe do your training after the danger passes.
It's a thing in Final Fantasy that I never knew.
There are a couple that have that kind of progression. Yeah, so like it's just a way to get free. You're not looking for experience points in this one. You're looking for job points, so you can just most people get the ability to just huck a rock. So what you end up having is this is one of my favorite analogies that that Gary came up with. You end up having like it's basically just like a Raymond Carver short story where all these people are chugging potions and then just slugging each other and hucking rocks at each other. Yeah. And Final Fantasy II, it's more directly like the thing that you do raises the stat. So like, you know, what Peter was saying was I needed more HP, so we needed to take a bunch of damage. And that's why we ended up hitting each other. So.
Yeah, that's. I know Valheim does that. Doesn't Skyrim do that as well?
Yeah, it's an Elder Scrolls thing.
Yeah. And that leads to some dumb behaviors all over.
And it also gets down to like, oh, I'm going to pick acrobatics or athletics as a main skill in Oblivion, and then you level up way too fast because it's a game where you're always running or jumping, and that's leveling you up. Yeah.
Yep. There might be like real life parallels. Like if you want to get good at comedy, you have to go to improv class, and that seems pretty ridiculous. So
yeah. That seems pretty ridiculous. Oh gosh. For mine, I'm going to say skiing in Tribes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
Wasn't initially a feature in the original one in Starseed Tribes, which is a game I never played. I kind of came in with Tribes 2, but it eventually became the series' entire hook. Skiing being because that is a game that has like weird voxel hills and you have a jetpack. The way that your momentum is calculated can be broken by basically like feathering your jetpack throttle while you're going down a slope, which will speed you up and then you'll launch off of the next hill that you go over. So just like people figured out in a rocket jump style way, a way to exploit this and move in ways that the developers didn't necessarily intend for. I also like that with the Team Fortress 2, like Team Fortress Classic, had rocket jumping, you know, just like Quake did or whatever. Team Fortress Classic also added concussion jumping, which is certain classes, namely the Scout and the Medic, have the ability to throw concussion grenades. What these would do is daze players, so the view would get all wobbly, but it also, like, propelled people away. So concussion grenade jumping was cooking the grenade, throwing it, and positioning yourself and jumping right when it goes off to basically launch yourself entirely across the map. It was way more effective than rocket jumping, but when you ended up wherever you were, you ended up, your view was going all, whoa.
Oh. Did that actually come with any penalties to aim accuracy, or was it purely cosmetic?
It was cosmetic. Like, yeah, you wouldn't be able to aim effectively because your view was going all over the place, but like those classes... You would not be doing that in order to get into a place to kill people. You would be doing that in order to get to a hard to access position, kind of behind enemy lines, and make a run for the flag or whatever the goal is.
Got it.
And by the time you got there, the dizziness was gone.
Yeah, very cool. You made me think for some reason of I think it was Battlefield Modern Combat back on the PS2, where the like. Reticle had 100% accuracy, and so people would, you know, set up the, like, oh, I'll shine a laser pointer on my screen to mark the center,
right,
and then be able to just run around and use my sniper rifle like a pistol.
Yeah, no scope it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Ben, how about you?
Yeah, I want to think that I'm wiser than just seeing Rocket and saying something with rockets in it, but I might not be. I was going to say Rocket League, I think, had like one of the best like emergent like mechanics with first like the aerial jumping as a way to like score goals or like kind of like outclass your opponents. And then on top of that, the one that I'm sure that they didn't really program around is the thing that the professionals do where it's like, if you land on the ball in midair, then you get an additional second jump, or that like resets, and then you can continue using that to juggle the ball. And I was never able to do that, but yeah, that was very impressive that the mechanics had that amount of depth to them. So
no,
yeah, that's crazy.
Just build a physics engine and watch stuff like that roll in.
Mm.
Yeah, Dennis, how about you?
Yeah, I'll go the deck builder route with this. Slay the Spire has a boss called Hexaghost, where one of its attacks scales with how much HP you have. And so you can intentionally take damage before the boss fight so that attack will be weaker.
Yeah.
And you know, part of the slay by comment discussion recently was around like, okay, do we take any damage? How much damage do we need to take before going into this? And it was just so funny to me that, you know, even if you're in a run where you're overpowered and don't really need it, you can still intentionally take some damage to make things counterintuitively easier for you in the boss fight.
Yeah. Nice. That's good answers. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, everybody, for participating. If you would like to participate in the multiplayer, go to the Duckfeed community group on Facebook. Watch for the prompts to go up on Monday afternoons. Thanks for posting this one.
The end boss.
Now it is time for the end boss, where we talk about things that are happening in the world of video games and how we feel about them. Ben, I was looking at the wrong one. Dennis, tell me... Don't give me hope, Dennis.
Oh, it's not me giving you hope. It's the ESRB, baby. So on April Fool's Day, when all kinds of shenanigans of varying degrees of funniness go up from gaming companies around the globe, one company had something that was actually real. And that was Silksong, the devs of Silksong. A new store page went up for Silksong on Xbox. It has had a store page for PlayStation and Switch as well for a while, so that's not necessarily the notable part. The notable part is that page came with a new ESRB rating,
yeah,
meaning that the game is at least finished enough to get a rating. And while there can be, you know, a ton of polish and improving that happens after the rating, generally that's a pretty good sign that the game is close to launch. So the dev themselves has confirmed that this is not an April Fool's joke. This is real, though they still have not committed to a launch date. It feels like Silksong, I don't even want to say it, might happen.
I mean, because time is moving forward, the odds are that we are getting closer to when it will eventually come out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we...
A 1,000 monkeys on 1,000 typewriters over the period of infinity will eventually type out the code for Silksong.
Yes. Yeah. 7 years. Like, I trust that team. They can, you know, they can do what they need to. Like, the more surprising thing to me is that they had enough runway to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, fingers crossed it means something. Who knows? It'll happen when it happens. I stopped I stopped wanting things.
Fair enough.
Now it's your turn, Ben. Well, you got two stories here.
So. Yeah, I was going to say, well, then if you don't want anything, these next two stories won't bum you out at all, and it's all good. Okay. I just have two. Instead of, like, we usually talk about, like, one bummer story every week, I brought two that I don't want to talk about too much in depth because they make me sad.
Okay.
But the first one is Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League. Had a DLC in the past few weeks where you can play as the Joker. And, like, the unanimous opinion of it has been that it's too grindy and not fun. And the fact that they, like, gate that behind, I think it's, like, I think it's like 70 missions or something like that. And then also the fact that they like didn't really deliver on any features that were like hinted to within the first season. So this is just kind of like another reminder that that game kind of sucks and it's kind of a clusterfuck and womp womp. Sorry.
Go play. This wasn't just positioned as a DLC. This is positioned as a new season, which theoretically is like, hey, here's months of new content for you, and it's literally a nothing burger.
Yeah, yep. So, more sad news with that. Just go back and play old Arkham games to feel joy.
Yeah.
And the second story is that the company that owns Gearbox, the makers of Borderlands, Embracer is their name, sold it to Take-Two for $500 million, well, I guess in the past few weeks. And then
or with... one Trump bond.
Oh, yeah. Original bond, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
JK, JK, apparently he's never held to accountability for anything.
Yeah.
Well, nevertheless.
We'll see.
Yes.
And then with that came news that Take-Two said that they're working on another Borderlands game, and we're going to put that out. But then also with that, which is the bummer, is that Gearbox also had layoffs then on the backside of this. So it's, shrug?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I do not like that there were layoffs. However, any game company getting out from Embracer is a good thing. Embracer is one of the worst things to happen to video games in a very long time.
Embracer Group is a friendlier way of saying all consuming group.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's a stand in for, you know, private equity, you know, just, vile, hate it. You know, I don't have a lot of affection for Borderlands, but also, I don't know, I don't want a team, I don't want a studio to be bought by somebody who's not interested in what they make and then dismantled. So good for them.
Maybe that Borderlands movie money will, you know, allow them to hire people back. I don't know, whatever.
You want to bet on that?
Nope. Okay. I am not investing in any of this.
Yeah. Oh gosh. For my story, this is a good thing, and it's also a classic something is happening story. Are you all aware of Bloodborne Cart?
No.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So Bloodborne Cart is a game that was announced as an April Fool's joke by an indie developer who had made the Bloodborne PS1. Kind of game, independent developer releasing stuff for free. They made a fake announcement for Bloodborne Cart and it got interest. And so they figured, well, let's go ahead and, you know, let's make this. People seem to be interested. Well, Bloodborne Card is no more. Sony killed it. However, from the ashes, a legally distinct game called Nightmare Cart, with all the characters slightly altered, is going to be released on May 31st. Released for free.
Every asset mirrored, yeah.
released for free with slightly different names. You know, if you notice a similarity between these characters and something from the Sony game Bloodborne, well, that's your problem.
You didn't.
Yeah.
Purely coincidence.
Yeah. I've been watching the development of this happen, you know, on Twitter since it was announced. The developer seems pretty cool. And I'm looking forward to messing around with it. Yeah.
Very fun.
Yep. So May 31st, coming on Memorial Day.
You get like blood sparks instead of blue sparks.
Maybe. Yeah. I'm excited about it. So yeah, any other, nothing else? How do we all feel about buttoning it up?
Buttons.
Thank you so much for listening to level number 495. We appreciate you taking the time. If you're listening to this on the day it comes out and you're in the Midwest, come out and see myself and Gary and other folks, other listeners who happen to be in the area at the Midwest Gaming Classic in Milwaukee. Our panel is on Saturday at noon. We're on the bonus stage. We are talking about video game adaptations. Which will be a good time. And then we're having a meetup at a place called The New Fashioned at 8 p.m. that night. For anybody who went to the meetup last year, it's at the same place. It just has a new name. You know, it's a bar, restaurant kind of place. We look forward to seeing you there. Otherwise, you know what to do to help out the show. I don't want to protract this. This has been a very efficient episode. I don't want to change that now. Dennis, anything you have going on?
Nope. Just Origins coming up, as I've said the past couple weeks. It'll be a good time.
All right. Cool. Well, this has been The Level, and I have been Cole Ross. You can find me on Blue Sky at Cole Ross.
I've been Dennis Furia. You can find me on Blue Sky at Furia Games.
I've been Ben Merkel, and you cannot find me.
And stick around for some titles. I only have one. It's something I said, which is Dirty Pool, but I'm going to say it because I liked it. I was proud of it. Flush the Spire.
I had poked the Spire.
Okay.
Well, so I like Flush better.
I had Spicy Pillow as a combo breaker.
Oh, gosh. Is that a Dennis original?
There's a subreddit called Spicy Pillow.
That's about swollen batteries.
Yes. So that's, I don't know how popular it was, but some picture came up of a spicy pillow, and that was in all the comments. So now I know this thing.
A term used to describe a failure state of lithium ion batteries. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh man, these pictures are distressing. Those are going to catch fire.
Oh boy. Yeah.
Are those the three we have? Flush the Spire, Poke the Spire, Spicy Pillow?
Yeah, I only wrote down the one.
Okay.
Sounds like a weird set of song lyrics.
Yeah. how do we feel about Flush the Spire?
I like it.
All right. Cool. Well, it is decided.